Okay, so the Song of Solomon, here we go. I didn't pick this book, it's just the next book in line. I also want to tell you, it's not an easy book. This is probably the most difficult book in the Bible to teach on. But it's also a book like unlike any other book in the Bible. There's no other book exactly like it. And it's also treated so very differently by different people. You know, some people just ignore it totally. Some preachers never go near it even with a stick. They just ignore it. Like Origen, you know, one of the early theologians in the church, you know, he was one of the guys, you didn't even touch it. He's just like, you can't go near it. The ancient Jews, they saw it as a very valuable part of their sacred writings, but they forbid their children, you know, to touch it, along with Genesis chapter 1 and Ezekiel, the prophecy of Ezekiel, the beginning and the end of it. They say you can't do that until you're 30 years old, you know, because it's just too mystical and you can't understand it. So they didn't allow the children to even read this book. There's others, people, they just rush this thing, like one teaching. I was very tempted to do that. Okay, so like you just go through it one time, get it over with, you know, get it done and it's finished. Then the other guys on the other side, they preach 122 sermons on Song of Solomon. You know, it's crazy. You know, the Puritan John Gill, there's another guy, a French guy, Bernard Clairvaux, and he preached 86 sermons on chapter 1 and chapter 2. You know? So there's a wide variety of things that people has done with this book in the very same way that people, the way that they approach it varies even greater, you know, because there's just so many approaches. You know, those who don't ignore it, like I say, some of them just ignore it, like we're not going to teach on it at all. But those who don't ignore it, you know, primarily many of them looks at it as allegory, as a symbolic book, you know, between the love relationship between God and his people. And through the early ages, especially the Puritans, that's the way they approach it. They're like, this is all about a love relationship between God and about his people, whether his people be the Jews, as the Jews said in the beginning, and later on the Christians, it's a love relationship between God and the Christians. Other people, they have looked at this and they say it's a drama and there's three characters in the drama. It's not Solomon and the Shunammite, it's Solomon, the Shunammite, and her shepherd lover. That's what they say. There's like three characters in the book, and Solomon is actually, you know, the king with all the influence and the power, and he fell in love with her, and he wants her to come be part of his harem that he really has, you know, and they like, she really loves the shepherd guy, and she doesn't want to leave him, and she's not interested in all the things that he's offering her. I don't really know where they get this, but a lot of people actually believe in that. Lately, you know, there's been a lot of teachings on the Book of Solomon. I don't know if you've noticed the last couple of years, and it seems like the later guys, they all just want to speak about sex. That's all they want to talk about. To them, it's like erotic literature from the East, and it's to them, it's all about sex, and it's just like the way they treat it these days, I just feel like it really shouldn't be treated like that. They believe everything that is written here, some sexual innuendo, and I don't believe that's what it's all about. So we want to deal with it, you know, like we deal with every book in the Bible. And we very seldom teach anything in the Bible as allegorical. Very seldom do we look at anything in Scripture as symbolic, because it's subjective. Once you start looking at it symbolically, you know, then everyone can start saying, well, you know, that's what I feel it says, and that's what I feel it says, and this is what I see in that. And everyone starts reading his own picture into the Word of God, and that's not exegesis. Exegesis is drawing out what the Word gives us, you know, drawing out the truth of God's Word, not reading into the text what I want to read into the text. Because then you can literally make the Bible say anything you want if you go around like that. So, you know, I don't believe this is mainly allegorical book at all. And it's dangerous looking at Scripture in an allegorical way, because every time that Scripture does give an allegory, every time it does give a symbolic meaning, it explains it. It interprets a symbol. Like in the book of Revelation, it says there's a dragon, and it tells you the dragon is Satan. You know, it interprets the illustration. But it's never just like an open thing that you can just interpret this like you want to. And so I think it's very important for us to not go into it like that, because Song of Solomon never claims to be allegorical. It never claims to be a symbol of something else. It is a straightforward, literal, powerful, romantic, sensual love story of a young girl who fell in love with Solomon and Solomon with her. And so that's really what the story is about. It reads like that. And I think the best way to look at this together as a church of God, the best way to view this book is like a love song, like a poem. because it's literally what it is. It's the Song of Solomon. People can't even agree on the title. It's like the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. But I think that's the best way we should look at it, is as a love poem. And then obviously there is some symbolic meaning. It's not, although it's not an allegorical book, I do believe there's some references that we definitely can make, some obvious references between Christ and the church. It's not to say we can't do that because of the marriage, because it's definitely speaking on marriage. And so I feel it's applicable to our marriages because of that. So it's not like we're not going to talk about that at all, but I feel as we read it, we need to be engaged with it. It's not the kind of thing where here's 5 points on how to save your marriage. This is a book that you have to get engaged with. You have to read it. You have to be in the story with these people. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like an opera. I don't know, you guys probably don't like opera. I'm probably not too fond of opera myself, but if you've ever seen opera, this is what happens. You know, the guy stands there and he sings in his baritone voice, and then the girl, she sings with her soprano voice, and then you have the choir at the back, like, whoa, you know, they just do the chorus. They do the chorus part, and this is sort of the daughters of Jerusalem. This is sort of the brothers, and this is exactly what it is. It's almost like a poem that is portrayed in this kind of way. And so that's the way that we're pretty much going to look at it. Ephesians 5:31 and 32 says, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." And that's why I say, because Paul specifically talks about this kind of thing, there is some that we can apply a symbolic meaning between us and Christ, and between marriage, between a husband and a wife, but to encourage us. But the church is the bride of Christ, according to Revelation 21, verse 9. And basically the whole story in the Bible, from Genesis to the end, is a love story. It's a love story of God coming for this world. And so we cannot deny that. I think it's just fair to look into it like that. But the fact is, it's very passionate. It's a very passionate story. I'll try not to blush too much. But as we go through this thing, you know, I think God desires our marriages to be full of passion. He made marriage for a reason. God said in the beginning, you know, he says, like, not good that man should be alone. And so God made marriage, and he made marriage to be passionate. And so this is a great example. And so first we want to look at, let's start there. It looks at the Shunammite. Verse 1 says, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." So pretty straightforward. The Song of Songs. This is sort of like saying the Holy of Holies. It's very similar to that. Because of all the songs that Solomon has written, this is the song. You know, the Song of Songs. This is like the Holy of Holies. And I think it's impressive. You think, like, someone like Solomon, he wrote like 3,000 Proverbs and he wrote 1,005 songs. We don't know where the other 1,004 is. We've got one, but we've got the best one. Okay? So don't worry about the rest. We've got the one, the song. You know, of all his songs he's written, this is the song, according to 1 Kings 4:32. And so this is directly opposing, that we just read the previous book, remember Ecclesiastes, vanity of vanities. The emptiness, you know, the emptiness of a world apart from God and its achievements, trying to attain that thing. This is the opposite. This is the Song of Songs, like singing out. This is the greatest of all songs. It focuses on that marital love and romantic part of a union of marriage. And so it's amazing if you think that the Song of Songs, we would think the Song of Songs in the Bible would speak about, you know, only God and His glory. But this is how highly God esteems this kind of thing in marriage. It's important to Him, and I think it's important that we look at it from that perspective. Because the Bible never sees marriage as weakness. Like some people, like, you know, you have to put self-control in, you know, don't get married, it's better for you not to get married. The Bible never gives that idea of marriage at all. It doesn't portray it as weakness, nor does the Bible say that physical love is impure. As a matter of fact, that's the way God made it for man and wife, man and woman to get together in that marriage bond in that way. Marriage was instituted by God before the fall. If you think about it, before anything happened, before Adam and Eve even sinned, that's when God instituted marriage. It was an important thing right from the beginning. Genesis 2:18, "And the Lord God said, it's not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." 1 Corinthians 7:3 says, "Let the husband render to his wife the affection due to her, and likewise the wife to her husband." So this is clearly a biblical command. God wants us, like I say, to be passionate in our marriages because it is important. And then it says, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon." So the Song of Songs is attributed to Solomon. He's mentioned directly 6 times, a number of times where he's just alluded to, like, as the king or whatever. In the Jewish tradition, They said the Song of Songs was written in his youth when he was still a young man. When he just got to the throne, he didn't have all these wives and things, and he fell in love with this one girl. In his Proverbs, he wrote in his prime as he was a strong man, and Ecclesiastes, he wrote at the end of his life as he was like just weary of life and the world and everything around him. That's traditionally the way the Jews saw it. And it's interesting to me that God would use a person like Solomon to write this beautiful song, seeing that he had like, you know, his 700 wives and his 300 concubines, and he couldn't have a proper relationship with any of them. So at the end of his life, of course, he was bitter, right? But it's amazing to me that God would choose someone like this to write this beautiful song that he puts together here. And like I say, it's a song like an opera with all these people singing these different parts and like these different groups. And it goes on there in verse 2. It says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." So here we see the young Shunammite girl. She's just starting to speak, and you can see she's in love. She's seriously in love. She's not saying he's kissing her. She said, "Let him kiss me." She's dreaming. She's desiring him to come and make this relationship, you know, like more personal and intimate. Maybe she's a country girl from Shunem, you know, Shunammite. Maybe she's not. We don't know exactly where she was from. The Bible doesn't tell us at all about her. But this is like exhilarating thing. She says, "Let him come and kiss me." This is a very passionate thing to say. Because, you know, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." So it's not like, "Let him kiss my feet," like, you know, like Mary Magdalene kissed Jesus' feet, or, you know, like Judas kissed Jesus on the cheek. It's not that. It's just like, "Let him kiss me," that personal, intimate, you know, one-to-one kind of person. That's what she's speaking about. It's very, very exhilarating. And we should, like I say, be engaged in the song. So as we read this, we should really read it as a poem, because it's beautifully written and it expresses so much here. And I think this is where some of the Puritans, especially this in early church, the guys felt uncomfortable with a lot of what it's saying here, because they just feel like, whoa, you know, it must be speaking about Jesus and the church, because there's no way, you know, that can mean anything else, because they were embarrassed by it. But I don't know about you, but, you know, somehow maybe it's because I'm a guy. But it's like, you know, when he talks about the curve of your thigh, you know, and your breasts and everything, it's like, I don't relate to God that way. You know, I just like, maybe it's just me, but to me it's like when they kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, I'm like, okay, you know, I love the Lord and I can feel his passion towards me, and but it's like, you know, it's slightly different for me than that. So, and so this young girl here, you know, maybe from the country, we don't know. But she says, "Your love is better than wine." So she's deeply, passionately, she's infatuated with him. She's actually intoxicated with him. She's like, it's like better than wine. That's better, more for me, the fact that I want to be with you than what wine can do for me. And then verse 3, it says, "Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth." She says, "You smell good. You smell so good. I can just imagine when I think of you, you know, you smell so good." And that's attraction. And I think attraction is very, very important. Obviously, most of you are married here. The unmarried ones, attraction is important. If you're not attracted to someone, don't get married to them. Like, it's a bad way to start, you know, the whole thing. So I think it's quite important. It's anything can happen. Like Ben reminded me today, you know, all things are possible through Christ. But if there's no attraction initially, you know, you're just putting an extra burden on this whole thing. It shouldn't even be there, right? So I think attraction is important. And she says, "Your name is ointment poured forth." So she saw him as a man, not only that smells good, but a man, you know, who has a good character. He's got a good character that he stands for, the things that he stands for, a good name. Because his character was to her like a bottle of cologne, you know, dropped open. That's like what his character was like to her. She says, "Your name is ointment poured forth." So not Hugo Boss, but Solomon, you know, whatever. It's like Solomon. That's like, that's the way, you know, that she looks at it. It's like how great your name is, you know. And so, I don't know, the kingly smell or something like that, whatever. But so therefore, she says, "The virgins love you." So basically she's saying, "You're the man, you know. You are the man for me. I'm not even considering anyone else, you are the man." And, you know, so all the unmarried girls really here, you know, they would go like, wow, you know, he's a catch. And that's what she's saying. You're the man. Of all the men that I can think of, you are the guy. You know, everyone loved him, not just because he was handsome, but because he had a character, you know, that was a godly, great character. And she says then in verse 4, therefore the virgins love you, so draw me away. Like I say, all the girls, when they look at him, like, man, that is the guy to have. And so she says, draw me away. And that's really her desire. She's like, I know, you know, you love me, and I need you to come and just take me away. She wanted to be with him. She wanted to be with him alone. And then we see the daughters of Jerusalem here. So this is where the chorus enters. You know, imagine it. We will run after you. So it's like they were singing this, you know. We will run after you, you know. I'm not going to sing it because I don't know it. But the daughters is like this onlooking chorus. And as she says these things in this drama that's unfolding, she's like, yo, I need you to be with me. And they're like, we'll run after you. So they are celebrating this thing. They say, we've seen this thing happen between you and Solomon. We are excited for you, and we want to celebrate your love with you. So they wanted to see how beautifully it builds on and grows, how this thing, they saw it starting out, and now they're like in the spring phase of their relationship, and they all like, we want to be part of this, you know, in the right way. And then she says there, the Shunammite again, the king has brought me into his chambers. And I don't think at this point she's speaking of his bedroom, because I believe this is still... You know, you can't lay out this book perfectly like some of the guys did. I remember when I was still single, I read this book of Tommy Nelson about Song of Solomon, and he had the whole thing laid out, like this is before you get married, and this is the engagement, and this is that, and this is that. I don't really believe you can lay it out like that, but I do believe this part, they're not consummated the relationship yet. They're not married yet. So to me, what I read here, it says, you know, the king has brought me into his chambers. It's probably a poetic and a symbolic thing in the sense that he welcomed her into the affections and the secrets of his heart. Because that word for chambers is the Hebrew word keder, and it means the inner chamber, the inner parts, the innermost part. That's really what that word means. So there's a lot of references there. So I believe this king has opened up to me his heart. You know, his deepest part is open up to me. And that's really what I believe she's saying at this point. And then at verse 5, the daughters again. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We'll remember your love more than wine. And then they say, rightly do they love you. So, you know, so they are basically saying, you know, we are rejoicing in this whole thing with you. We are with you in it, and we're excited this whole thing is happening with you. And then she speaks and she says, rightly do they love you. So looking at the way that all these daughters of Jerusalem are going on, she's like, man, they are right to say this about you because you are a great guy, you know, and I totally agree with everything that they're saying. Revelation 19 verse 7 tells us that, let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. So it's always an exciting thing. We see that even at the end where we are going to be united with Christ, you know, that there's an excitement in that. And so that all these daughters of Jerusalem are celebrating because they are excited about that. And then as the Shunammite there says, she's feeling that their high estimation of the guy that she loves. She's like, you're right on, you know, this is the guy. But then she looks at herself in verse 5 and she says, I'm dark, but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar. So she says, she's very humble because now she sees herself and she says, when I look at Solomon, he's great. When I look at myself, I'm not that attractive. I'm not as attractive as in the same category really as he. That's the way she says it. So she's very humble. But she's still lovely. She just doesn't see herself as great. And she says, I'm dark. Now it's not saying she's coming from Ethiopia. We'll see now. She's got a suntan. She's been working hard, right? And it says, so she's saying, O daughters of Jerusalem, she's singing this to them again. And she says, like the tents of Kedar. Now that's the territory southeast of Damascus. And the Bedouins, they make their tents with the black skins of their goats. And so that's like the blackness. And she's like, I'm tanned like that. So as she looks at her skin and she compares herself to him, because in those days, it's interesting how cultures vary. Because in those days, obviously, a fairer skin, you know, was esteemed higher. The lighter you are, and it's been like that, I think, for a long time. We live in a society where everyone loves a tan person, but in those days, you know, it's like the fairer your skin is, the better. And so she looks at herself and she's like, I'm not like him in that sense, you know. And then in verse 6, she says, don't look on me because I'm dark. Like, don't look at my tan like that, you know. I know, you know, don't look at me like that. Because the sun has tanned me, my mother's sons were angry with me, they made me the keeper of the vineyards. And so that's interesting, because now she says, the sun has darkened his skin because of manual labor. She's been working hard. She's not the typical pampered girl, you know, who grew up with all the soft comforts around in her life. She was working very hard. She was not like the fairer maidens who had like a light skin. And she hasn't had all the beauty treatments and all that kind of things, but she has a lovely character. And that's obviously what Solomon saw and what Solomon fell in love with. He fell in love with her for more than what she just looked like. Obviously, she was beautiful to him, but there was something just appealing about her, you know, just a natural beauty in her. And like I say, in her culture, being tan is not beautiful. And it's interesting, our culture always sets an abnormal standard for beauty that women can never achieve. It's just interesting because, you know, culture portrays some kind of, this is what a woman should look like, you know, put it, see on TV and everything, and everyone's like, okay, I guess I should look like that. But it's unattainable. So it's a crazy thing, and the same thing happens here. As she looks at what is acceptable, she's like, I'm not like that. She said, my mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyard. So her brothers put her to work in the field, right? It's almost like a Cinderella story. It's like they made me work. You know, my brothers, they put me out there. I wasn't able to stay at home like a lot of the other girls, and so I couldn't do that. And I think probably Solomon was drawn to her in a sense because of the genuineness and because of the natural beauty that she had, because she was not like all the other girls. She didn't sit at home and just think about herself and her thing. She was working hard. She was someone with character, and maybe that's what he really liked. If you think about the Proverbs 31 woman that Solomon wrote about, you know, maybe this is more how he felt about her, that she is esteemed above all girls, all women. At the end there of verse 6, she says, but my own vineyard I have not kept. So looking at herself, she's like, you know, I've worked hard in the vineyard, but my own vineyard, I haven't taken care of myself as I should have. You know, so, you know, obviously this is why I'm tan and everything like that. But there's a genuineness in her, there's humility in her, and even though she neglected her, you know, outward appearance, Solomon was obviously still in love with her, very much in love with her. And I think if you think back, you know, like those of you who are married now, if you think back to when you met your spouse, you know, what was that initial thing, you know? I remember vividly, like, you know, I thought to myself, you know, Ridley can wear a black refuse bag and she looks the best of anyone else. You know, it's like, doesn't matter, you know, those things just doesn't matter because it's not just about, you know, what she looks like. I remember personally that, you know, that is the thing that attracted me to her. I love to hear her pray. She had a relationship with the Lord. I would love to sit there and just hear how she prays. You know, it's something that I love. You know, I was in a cell group with my parents-in-law now at that stage. And it was amazing to me. That's what drew me to her, you know. Yes, I was attracted to her, but there was much more than that. I think it's the same here with Solomon as he looks at. And I think it's sometimes necessary for us to remember these things. Marriage as a way of, after a couple of years, after quite a long time, you start forgetting what you felt like in the beginning. These things become, you like, you get used to it, and, you know, things fade down a bit, and it shouldn't be like that, really. And she says in verse 7, tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make the rest at noon, for why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? Now she's basically telling him, I need to know where you are. Where are you at the whole day? Some people look at this, and because he speaks about the flocks and because of the way that it's phrased there, it says, where you feed your flock. Some people say, well, obviously he must have been a shepherd, so it couldn't be Solomon. So they create this whole problem out of this situation. We don't know exactly what the thing is, but look at the words there in your Bible. Your flock is in italics. If you look at the original, it's not even there. So it basically says, where do you feed? That's what she says. I looked at the words in the Hebrew. That's what she says. She's like, where are you eating? It's not where do you feed your flock necessarily. Where are you eating? Where do you make it rest at noon? And that means literally, where do you lay down? So it's like, where do you eat? You know, where do you sleep? You know, where do you hang out basically? I would like to know because I would like to be there. Wherever you are, I like to be there. That's really the point of what she's making of this. She wants to be close to him. She says, where do you make your rest at noon? So she's humble, first of all, like I said, because she's not flashy about it. She doesn't want to go around like hunting this guy and making this whole show like, I want to be where he is. So she asks him, where are you? I want to know where you're going to be eating, where you're going to be laying down, because I would like to be near you. Secondly, she has integrity because she doesn't want to look like one of the loose girls, you know, who run around after a guy just to get the guys. She tries to have integrity. She's got a reputation, and she knows that as people look at her, they must still regard her because she's seeking an honorable man and she wants to keep that reputation up there. And so maybe the king was just like a shepherd to his people. That's what maybe what she was speaking about. But it's clearly that she wanted to be with them. So she says there, why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? So basically, she's like, why do I need to hide myself? In those days, the women that veiled themselves were the sexual immoral women normally. They were the harlots who were sitting by the wayside. If you think about something like Genesis 38, verse 13 to 15, where Tamar, Judah treated her wrong, and she veiled herself and she goes sat there by the road, and he thought she was a harlot, and he went into her. Right? And so that's the way that the women in those days did it. The ones who veiled themselves were trying to hide something. They were trying to, and she's like, why do I need to go around like that? Just tell me where you're going to be. And so you can just see the passion for him. She's just like lovesick. She wants to be wherever she can find him. And I think this is a point, you know, those of you who may be not married, you know, this is a point I think where you're ready for marriage, is when you don't have to compromise any aspect of your relationship with the Lord. If you don't have to compromise anything, who you are with the Lord. Because if you have to compromise something to get married, it's not worth it. I always say to people before they get married, is this going to be bring you closer to the Lord? Or are you going to be further away from the Lord if you would marry this person? Because if you marry the person, they take you further away from the Lord, it's not worth it. No matter how great they are, it's simply not worth it because you never want to be removed from the Lord. Ideally, as you step into a marriage relationship, you should inspire one another to live closer to God. Because it's always, like I said to the guys, it's like a triangle. I've been doing a lot of marriage counseling lately, everyone getting married. And so it's like a triangle. The closer you move to God, the closer you move to one another. That's really what it's all about. And so I think it's important to understand it, to be ready for marriage. Then the next thing we see in verse 8, now the beloved speaks. And he says, if you do not know, O fairest among women, follow the footsteps of the flock. So he's like, if you don't know where I feed, if you don't know where I lay down, then just follow the flock. You know, follow in the footsteps of the flock. So he welcomes her presence. He welcomes her companionship. He's like, hey, she likes being around me, and I like that. You know, it's like he wants her there. He says, like, it's great. I'll tell you exactly. You just follow them. And by the way, on the man's list, on the guy's list of things that's important to him in the marriage, this is number two, companionship. Guys love companionship. That's why they marry a woman. They want someone to be their companion. And so he's like, hey, she wants to come hang out with me wherever I am. Great, I'll tell you where I'm going to be because I want you to be there. I want someone to be a companion that I can walk in this life with. And so it's the important thing. He says, you can feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. And so he promises grace and good things to her. He's like, if you're there, we'll take good care of you. Don't worry about anything. And then he says to her in verse 9, I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Now, he compares it to a horse. I don't know how well it will go off, you know, with the woman today. If you say to your honey, you look like a horse, you know, it's like. So I don't know how well it will go off, but in that day, obviously, the thing is Solomon, it's a typical guy thing. I mean, he loves horses, right? Solomon loves horses. To him, it's one of the nicest, most beautiful things that he can think of. And I mean, if you think about 2 Chronicles 1:16, it speaks how he imports the horses from everywhere. So to Solomon, that's a great compliment. You know, you're like a filly between Pharaoh's chariots. And so whether he was just speaking about the chariots, he's basically saying, you know, to me, you like this young living thing that runs around between all these dead wooden things. Really? You know, so you are so different from anyone else. And maybe in that day it was really romantic to say that. So I think you must find something else if you want to say that to your wife. But basically, you know, he's trying to tell her that you are one of a kind. You are totally different from anything else around you. Everything else pales in comparison to you. And it's like that excitement about a young filly. Because I don't think your wife will appreciate it when you tell her you're like a mare. You know, hey, you're Mary. It's not going to work. So, verse 9, he says there, I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots, and your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. She's like, I love the way you wear your jewelry. You know, I love the way that you put these things on yourself. I love the way that whatever it is you do. You know, it's like, I just love that. You know, and you need to tell each other. That's something also that we do those things as we are dating, you know. You're like, oh man, you look so great in that. You're like, amazing. I love it when you wear that. couple of years into marriage, you're like, why are you wearing that? You know, it's like, it's like everything changes. It's sad. It's unnecessary to be like that. And I think one of the things as we read through this is to be reminded again, like, you were once very much in love with your spouse. You were very much into this person that you married. And so to start looking at them in that way again, I think it's quite important. He says, your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. So he just praises her really for the way that she beautifies herself. And she obviously wanted to look good for him, so she, you know, put all these things on. And once again, the culture of that day was slightly different from the culture today. So I don't think it would necessarily work in the same way. Verse 11, the daughters, now the chorus comes in here from the side again. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. You know, all the girlfriends get together. Ooh, he likes you. You know, it's like, this is going to be so great. Let's have a party, a makeup party. We'll get together and we'll do you up, you know, and you'll look even better. It's like, that's really what they're saying. Like, we'll just get together and everyone will help you in this. And we are so excited for you. And that's the whole thing. You know, all these girls together with that. And then she speaks again. She says, while the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. And so, you know, what she's really saying here is she's so aware of her attractive power. She's aware of the fact that how he looks at her. She's aware of the fact that she has got a power over him in that sense that she can draw him by her beauty. She's so aware of it. So she says, as he sits at a table, you know he's aware of me. My fragrance, you know, is going out to him. And she knew that she could draw him. And then in the same sense, in verse 13, she says, a bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. And so basically in the same sense, she's saying, he's the same to me. Like, I know that he draws me too. I know I can draw him. I can see the way that he looks at me, even when he sits at his table, if he's busy with something else. I know he's aware of me, and she knows the power that she has, but she also says he has got the same power over me. Because, you know, I can't stop thinking about him. Even when I go to bed at night, you know, I lie there and it's just like I think of him and just that fragrance lingers. You know, just think sometimes, you know, when you're dating or something, there's something left behind, like a scarf or something, and you're like, oh man. Feels like, you know, she's right there still, you know, or he's right there still. Hopefully he didn't leave his scarf with you, whatever. But it just feels like, you know, even you just smell that smell and you're like, oh, it feels like he's right here with me at the moment, you know. And that's basically what she's saying here. And she's secure in his love. So she feels like he doesn't even have to be immediately there as long as she's reminded of who he is to her. I remember, you know, when I dated, I was... You know, well, really before I dated, Rudri, I was overseas and I was always thinking of her everywhere I went. And all kinds of things reminded me of her. I would always pick up little rocks in all the different countries I went to and I mailed her rocks. Can you believe it? I mailed her rocks. And she got these things in the mail, little rocks. It's crazy, but me and her, we both love rocks, you know? And so that was just, but I was far away from her, and yet, you know, every time I saw something like that, I couldn't stop thinking of her. You know, it's just amazing how it works. She's trusting him because she knows he doesn't have to be right there. As long as she's reminded, as long as she's got something of him, you know, she says, it lies between my breasts the whole night. And, you know, that's where, once again, I say some people, they go into an allegory in these kind of things. They try to explain everything in the sense of Christ and the church, and it becomes a little weird, you know. Especially when it comes to something like that. They don't really want to look at the word breasts. You know, the Jews, they try to make it like as Moses and Aaron, the breasts, you know. And I mean, if you start going there, then you're sort of getting a little carried away. You know, they look at it, all these kind of things. The Christians, the early Christians, they talked about this part here as her breast, about, you know, the way that the church is fed. And it's the New Testament and the Old Testament, that kind of thing, you know. And I really don't think that was what is intended here. So like I say, if you start getting into allegory, you can get carried away crazily. You know, so what she's saying is, I'm lying there and I'm thinking about you the whole night and you are right there with me because I can still smell you. You know, that's really what she's saying. Verse 14. She says, my beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. So that's a beautiful picture because henna blooms, there's a sexual connotation to henna blooms just like there is to pomegranates and that kind of thing. But it's a beautiful blossom. She says, like, you're like a fragrant flower to me, you know. Once again, it's like now she's speaking. When he's speaking, it's like, you're like a horse, you know, men like horses. The woman looks at him, she's like, you're like a flower, you know. It's like, women like flowers, you know, so that they're both expressing the thing that is beautiful to them, you know. And I think it's just interesting because that's where men and women differ so much. We differ so much, and still, the way that we feel love, we want to give love in that same way. You know the whole love language kind of thing. And oftentimes we are like that. I experience love like that, so if I want to give love to her, I'm going to give her love like that. Or if she feels love in a different way, she's going to give love to me in that way and think that I'm necessarily going to get love. So both are speaking from their perspective. And she's like, you know, he's like a henna bloom, you know. So that's the way that she sees it. But a beautiful picture, really, because she says, in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Now, En-Gedi is this famous oasis in the Judean wilderness. It's near the Dead Sea. And it's this beautiful, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of En-Gedi, but it's like the waterfalls and the pools. It's like in the midst of a barrenness. There's a barrenness of almost like a desert around. And then you have this oasis there in En-Gedi. And she's saying, like, that's what he's like to me. I find comfort. I find rest in him. It's like a beautiful blossom in this oasis where everything around is barrenness. So that's the picture that she's speaking about here as she says this. And then in verse 15, the beloved speaks again, Solomon speaks, and he says, behold, you are fair, my love, behold, you are fair, you have dove's eyes. And so, basically just telling her, you are so beautiful, you're so beautiful, and he can't stop saying it. And I want to remind you again, when you were dating, you couldn't stop saying this to each other, to your spouse, like, you are so beautiful. I love it. You know, I love this and I love this. And I think it's important for us to be reminded of that because we neglect it. We neglect each other. We stop telling each other how much we love each other. We stop telling each other how much we mean to each other. We stop telling each other because your wife wants to know that she's still beautiful to you. You understand? That's an important thing. My wife reminds me every now and then. She's like, am I still beautiful? I'm like, yeah, you know? It's like, it's not like guys are sort of like, I said it on the wedding day and I mean it for the rest of my life. That's not what she wants to hear, okay? She needs to be reminded that you think she is beautiful. And I think it's important. So he just says, you are beautiful, you are fair, my love. You know, as he's romancing her, he tells her how beautiful she is to him. And he's just praising her beauty. And I think it's always something that's applicable in marriage. You should continue telling your spouse that she is beautiful to you, you know, your wife or your husband, that he is handsome. You know, we're going to get to that right now. I think it's an important thing for him to say, and it's an important thing for her to hear. Because if he doesn't say it, it doesn't exist. And it's important for her to hear it because it gives her that security and that safety. Like, I know you still feel about me like you used to feel about me when we stood before, you know, the pastor or whatever. I think it's an important thing. He says, you have dove's eyes, like beautiful little eyes, you know, no deceit. If I look at you, it's just beautiful and everything is nice and I can't see anything bad in you whatsoever. Once again, things change over the period of marriage. It shouldn't change like that. You should still feel that same way. Obviously, you can't have that same excitement that you had in the beginning because your relationship matures, everything matures. But it's still important to tell one another these things. And then there, the last two verses, she speaks again. And she says, behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. And so now she responds like, you're a hunk. He's like, you're a babe. And she's like, you're a hunk, you know, and that's good. And so she's telling him what he wants to hear. You know, that's on. If you look at the women's list, that is something that she needs. She needs affection. She needs to know that you are interested in her. She needs to know that you still feel the same. She needs that security. One of the things about a woman is she wants that security. She wants that commitment to go through. And you must remind her of that because that's just the way the Lord made it. But also for the guy on the other side, you know, he wants to know, like, I'm the man, you know, I'm your man. There's nothing that makes your husband feel better than when you tell him, oh man, you're so strong. You're like, you look so good, you know, you walk in the door. You know, it's like, guys like that because, I don't know, they maybe have a low self-esteem or something, but they need someone to tell them that they look good, right? So it's important. So he calls her beautiful. She responds with the masculine form of the same word here, the same Hebrew word. And she says, you are handsome, my beloved. And you can see where this is going. Imagine now if you and I were still doing this thing like we started doing it when we just got married. If we keep telling each other every day how great we are. I love you. You're so beautiful. Yes, you're a hunk. Honey, man, I can't be away from you. Yes. If we speak like that to each other every day, then how many problems would we have? Do you understand? This is a very important thing. But we regress in the way we speak to each other. We sort of forget about what we feel for each other. We forget that this is the one person that God gave us for each other. And we start speaking in a way that's just derogatory to sometimes, you know, just breaking each other down. Just this week, I sat down in marriage, premarital counseling, and we spoke about communication, how important that is. You know, communication is so important. The Bible says with your words, you can break someone down or you can build someone up. And I think it's so important. I think this is a very, very crucial thing. Obviously, communication is one of the most important things in marriage, but the way that you speak to one another. You know, do you feel love? And this is not to say, oh, you know, he never says something nice to me or she never says something nice to me. Do you say something nice to them? That's the thing. You can only do your part. You can only... And the thing is, you don't have to make it up because that's what you felt like, you know, when you got married. That's exactly what you felt like. You had so much to say. And now you walk in like, you know, and if you're really in a friendly mood, it's like, how was your day kind of thing. But it's not like, oh, you're so beautiful. I rushed home from work, you know, kind of thing to get you. Because that builds each other up. If you are in that kind of relationship, that encourages one another and you feel that love again because you start speaking to each other in a beautiful way. And I think it's important for all of us. And so maybe if that is missing in your marriage, then there's something maybe to work on. If that is something, if just think about the way that you speak to each other. So a husband and wife can have a very powerful effect on each other in the way that they speak to each other. She goes on and she's just enraptured. You know, she says, also, our bed is green, the beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters are fir. So basically, this is image of walking in the countryside and seeing it as the place where they're just together, you know, this whole beautiful scenes, these pictures, and every picture she sees is like, it's our love relationship, you know, that is displayed right before us. So she pictures the great outdoors as their house, you know, the grass as their bed, the overhanging trees as their roof. She's like, you know, we are just here. And just think about, that's why I called it the Garden of Love, Song of Solomon, because I think this is the springtime, springtime in the relationship. This is where everything is just super exciting and everything is super nice. You know, you skip around and everything is green and beautiful and every flower you see like, oh, it's so nice, you know. And obviously we can't stay there. There's a maturing that gets in, you know. The trees get bigger. But the whole idea here is that I want to mention is you need to be tending the garden. You need to be tending your garden if you want the trees to mature and grow in the right way. You need to be putting in that fertilizer. It's dirty work. You know, it's hard work. You need to be watering. You need to be doing all the things that is necessary to build your garden because God has given each one of you a garden. And each one of us is responsible to build into that garden. And if you just neglect the garden, just think, you know, I just think I've got some of my trees in my yard that I really like, some of the plants that I really enjoy, and I give them a lot of attention. But if I would just ignore them, especially with the water restrictions, you know, they would just die. They would wither away. And that is what happens to many, many marriages. Because both parties aren't involved in tending the garden, in looking after this garden that makes everything grow. And I think as we're looking at the springtime, it's exciting, but things have to grow up, but you have to keep putting in. And like you've maybe heard many times before, marriage is hard work. Yes, it is. Marriage is hard work. It's not easy to have a successful marriage because we have an enemy that fights against us all the time. It's important if we want to have a good marriage to make that a priority in our lives. Obviously, our relationship with the Lord is first. We need to put that first. But second relationship is your marriage relationship. That is more important than your kids. It's more important than your work. It's more important than anything else. And so you need to be investing in the garden that God has given you. I just feel that's one of the reasons why marriages don't stay exciting, because we gave up working in the garden. We just like, that thing must just get on by itself, and that's not the way to do it. Do you understand? And so if we want our relationship to mature, we still need to tend it. And so I want to ask you, are you working on your marriage? Are you working, you know, in your garden? And as we're looking at this first chapter, this is really the springtime where everything's exciting, and we're going to get to the other parts. But I just want to end with Psalm 1, verse 1 to 3. It says, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. And that's really not only my desire for all of us, that's God's greater desire for all of us. He wants us to prosper. He wants us to be like a plant who's right there by the water. You know, we've got a little stream here at the back, and that's the plants that grows the best because they've got roots right down there. And so even when the thing is not flowing, at least there's still moisture there. The other ones I have to make a plan with. But God says, if you are in my word, and if you are putting what I tell you to be putting first, if you prioritize your life according to what I give you, then you will be blessed.